was his life, it was what he knew and what he loved. He knew the Sea of Galilee like the back of his hand. He was probably almost born in the fishing boat because he was from a fishing family. He knew the beauty of that sea when the sun breaks over the mountain in the early morning, or when it sets in the evening, painting the sky with all sorts of colours of red and yellow and orange. But he was also aware that that same sea could be very treacherous. It's very well known that the Sea of Galilee is subject to very violent storms that turn up very, very quickly and unexpectedly. You'll know the story of how Jesus was asleep in the boat earlier on in his ministry, and the disciples got really panicky because they thought the boat was going to sink, and they couldn't understand why Jesus was laying there in the bottom of the boat fast asleep. He knew that lake. He knew the trade. And no doubt he knew the people, hundreds of people who fished that lake. The Jewish historian Josephus tells us that there were as many as 300 fishing boats at the time of Jesus on that lake. Now, if you assume two people per boat, that's 600 people just there working through the night. We can only imagine the banter that would have gone on between the crews of the different boats, the friendships, the comradeship that they built up. For as long as he could remember, he had plied his trade on the Sea of Galilee. Then Jesus called. Three fateful words. Come, follow me. Three words which changed the whole of his life. Come, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. They left their nets and they followed him. From that moment on, Jesus gave them a new lease of life, a new direction in life. From that moment on, fishing was no longer the main part of their lives. The whole direction changed from what they had known. A new hope, a new purpose, and a totally new outlook on life. I personally am not totally convinced that Peter and his colleagues never went fishing during the 3 years they were with Jesus. There's certainly references to the fact that the boat was kept because Jesus used it on many occasions, or a number of occasions, used it as a pulpit to teach the people. And there may well be times when things weren't quite so busy when he was with Jesus that he had a night's fishing. After all, they needed food. Maybe sometimes he caught them some. But you use your own imagination on that one. We're not told. When we come to John 21, we find seven of Jesus' disciples together beside the Sea of Galilee. Peter, Thomas, Nathanael, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, and two others. One of which was probably Peter's brother Andrew. Seven bored men. Why were they there? Why were they sitting there by the edge of the Sea of Galilee? Well, Mark tells us in chapter 16, verse 7, that when Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, went to the tomb to anoint Jesus' body on the first Easter day, that the young man they saw there in the tomb said to them, "Tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." But when they got there, he was nowhere to be seen. So they were there, waiting, watching, hoping that soon he would come, probably wondering whether he would show up at all. In fact, they were just a little bit at a loose end, as we would say. Their world had fallen apart. Jesus had been crucified. He died. They knew that. He'd been buried. And they were only just beginning to understand that he was risen from the dead. and certainly only just beginning to understand what that might mean to them. And as yet, they had no idea what the future would hold for them now that Jesus had gone, even though they said that he was alive again. But he wasn't there physically with them. And yet they had no idea what was going to happen. They had to find the future direction for their lives. Daylight was beginning to fade. The sun was beginning to set. Perhaps they were hungry. Maybe they'd had nothing to eat. And there were plenty of fish, but they were all still in the sea. Perhaps they were sitting by the water's edge, as we many of us like to do, and just contemplating what's been happening. Or maybe they were doing what the men tend to do, picking up smooth stones and skimming them to see how many times they can make them bounce on the water. They might even have been pacing up and down, wondering, when on earth is he going to turn up? And all this inactivity was too much for Peter. He was the action man. Peter breaks the boarding. He can take it no longer. He says, I'm going fishing. And the others said, we'll go with you. Some people criticize Peter for what he did. They say that he was just falling into sin again, turning away from Jesus, going back to his old life. But he wasn't really running away, was he? Because he came back to the same place in the morning. And it's interesting that Jesus never criticized him for going fishing that night. Not one word of criticism is included in the New Testament for that act. So there may have been bored doing nothing, but things were going to get somewhat worse in the next few hours. Back in the 1850s, someone called W.M. Thompson describes night fishing on the Sea of Galilee. And he describes it like this. He says, it's a wonderful sight. With blazing torch, the boat glides across the flashing sea. The men stand gazing keenly into it until their prey is sighted. When quick as lightning, they fling out their net or they let fly the spear. But he adds, but often you see tired fishermen come sullenly into harbour in the morning, having toiled all night in vain. I must admit that some years ago now, when we had the privilege of standing by the Sea of Galilee one night, the only sound we could hear then was not joyful fishermen or miserable fishermen. It was the sound of disco boats and rock music taking people, partying people across the Lake of Galilee. Their fishing was a fruitless exercise, not fruitful. Their fishing was a fruitless exercise because they caught nothing. All night they had fished, and they caught absolutely nothing. Yet another disappointment to add to the disappointments that they had lived through over the last few days and weeks. Tired, hungry, fed up, they make their way to the shore. Then in the half-light of dawn, they make out a figure on the beach. A bloke standing on the beach, for want of a better word. They didn't know who it was. All they could see was this figure. And to add insult to injury, as they get close to the shore, he shouts out to them, have you any fish? Cast your net on the right side of the boat. I am absolutely amazed. I don't know about you, but I know that what I thought Peter would do. And it wouldn't be in very choice words what he told him to do with his instructions. But he didn't, strangely enough. Maybe Peter is beginning to learn to keep that mouth shut until he's really thought what he wants to say. They listen to what he says. They take advice. They throw out the net and they try and haul it in. And it's full of fish. They have a job to bring it into the boat. 153 fish, all big ones. Amazingly, the net holds. Then the penny begins to drop. The disciple whom Jesus loved turned to Peter and said, it's the Lord. Peter, impulsive as ever, jumped into the water to go and greet Jesus, leaving his colleagues in the boat to bring in the fish that they had caught. I was left asking, what is this miracle that my Bible entitles this passage? Jesus and the miraculous catch of fish. What was the miracle? The size of the catch was a miracle. In their wildest dream, they would never have expected a catch of that size. The size of the fish was a miracle. If they'd have been all been little ones, you could accept that. But 153, all big ones, no little tiddlers to throw back. That's a miracle for any fisherman. The fact that the net remained intact, that was a miracle. It wasn't designed to take that many fish. The fact that the big shoal of fish appeared just at the right time in the right place when Jesus told them where to throw the net, that was a miracle. Some of these disciples had been professional fishermen all their lives. They knew that sea. They knew exactly where to expect the fish at what time of day and night. Yet all night they had toiled and caught nothing. And now their nets are full and overflowing. These miracles proved to the disciples that the man on the shore was not any old man, it was Jesus. It was Jesus risen from the dead. The story moves on. They come face to face with Jesus. He had so little time left before he would ascend to his Father in heaven. He knew that it wouldn't be long before he had to go and leave them. He had so much that he needed to teach them. He had such a problem to prepare them for what lay ahead, because he tried and tried and they didn't seem to understand what he was saying. He needed to encourage them that this is not the end, but the beginning of something new and something exciting. He needs to sort out Peter, because three times he's denied that he even knew him. So what does he do? Sit them down and start teaching them? No. Begin to explain what was happening to him? No. Start to tell them what would happen next? No. He sees a group of tired and hungry men. He's already got the fire lit. He greets them with the smell of barbecued fish, cooked, ready and waiting. As the disciples stepped out of the boat onto the shore, tired and hungry after a long night's fishing, he greeted them with an offer they could not refuse. Come and have breakfast. The most welcome words they could ever have heard, come and have breakfast. Words which brought comfort. Words which showed them that he cared, that he loved them, that he cared about their needs and knew their needs. Come and have breakfast. In that simple act, he showed them how much he loved them. He showed them how much he cared. They'd worked all night. They were tired. They were hungry. At that moment in time, the one thing they needed was food. So he said, come and have breakfast. If it had been us, he would probably have said, come on, have a cup of tea. The kettle's already boiling. He took bread and he gave it to them. And I guess that as he did that, he broke bits off, as he had done around the table the night before he was crucified. And then he did the same with the fish. And that too would have brought back memories of the day that Jesus fed those 5,000 people with a young lad's lunch of bread and fish. This time, they were the ones who were hungry, not the crowd. This time, he's feeding them. It's real bread. It's real fish. It's satisfying their hunger. He's a real man. They've seen him a few times now since he rose from the dead. He appeared in locked rooms and disappeared again But somehow this was different. Not only can they see him, he's talking with them. He's lighting fires. He's gutting fish, cooking it for them. Not imaginary fish, real fish. Fish they can eat and which satisfies their appetite. He's handling tangible things, breaking off chunks of bread and giving it to them. And I wouldn't be very surprised if there was some wine to wash it down to. None of them dared to ask who it was. In all these things, they knew that it was Jesus standing there on the seashore that morning. And more important, they knew that he was alive and that he was real. Earlier in his ministry, Jesus had greeted people with a very, very similar invitation. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. A few years ago, there was a song which became quite popular that said simply this: cast your burdens onto Jesus, for he cares for you. Jesus invites us to do that this morning. This morning, he invites us to come to him, to come with our burdens, with our worries and our uncertainties, with our doubts and our fears. He invites us to come and find our rest and our peace with him. He invites us to receive his love, his care, and his provision. He doesn't come to promise that everything will be easy. He never promised that to the disciples that morning. In fact, it wasn't many verses later that we read he begins to tell Peter what's going to happen to him, and it wasn't nice. But he comes to us this morning and invites us to come to him so that he can equip us and sustain us to face up to the future that lays ahead, the unknown that is tomorrow. As Jesus welcomed those disciples by the seaside that morning, so he welcomes each one of us this morning to come to feed on his provision, because he knows what we need. He knows what the future will hold for us. And he has the resources to see us through whatever that might be. Come and have breakfast. Come and spend time with him. Come and be refreshed by what he wants to give to you. Amen.